It is with the deepest shame and sense of misery that I have to admit it. Yes, I was there. On the greatest day of infamy in our summer game, it was my profound misfortune to be present and indeed play a central part in the wretched proceedings which so marred and scarred the Saturday of the centenary test at Lord's. Let us be quite clear about one thing. In no way do I condone the attitude of those spectators who abused and in some cases physically assaulted the two umpires on the steps of the pavilion. While I have considerable sympathy with the views of those who maintain that anyone who has the effrontery to look like Mr. Harold Dickie Bird, or even to be Mr. Harold Dickie Bird, deserves to be given a thorough thrashing every morning of his life, I believe that these feelings should never be allowed public expression, especially at headquarters. While I believe, too, that the England captain, Mr. Ian Botham, has the looks and the manner of a recently made redundant chef on a British Rail dining car, and that his Australian counterpart, Mr. Greg Chappell, bears a remarkable resemblance to a cheroot-toting lieutenant colonel in some vile-smelling Central American republic, this gives no one license to express outright contempt towards them. However, when all is said and done, and although it pains me to the core of my soul to say it, on the day in question, it is easy to understand and to forgive the baseness of behaviour by everyone concerned. And it is even easier to point the finger at those responsible for such ghastliness. The guilty ones must be named. They are none other than the authorities. They, and they alone, must take full responsibility for the day of infamy. And why? Because basic common sense should have told them that their actions could have done nothing else than provoke unseemly violence, outright mutiny and rowdyism of a type only normally seen at an annual conference of the Conservative and Unionist Party. Putting it quite simply, it was just asking for trouble, locking me in the pavilion gents' urinals with Mr. K.D. Slasher Mackay. From that, and from nothing else, stemmed what will forever be known in the annals of our summer game as the Troubles. As calmly as I can, I shall now describe the events of that fateful day. As always, on the Saturday of the Lord's Test, I rose at 3:30 in the morning so as not to disturb the lady wife and her confounded Bedlington terriers, and made my way in stockinged feet through the rose shrubberies where friends were waiting for me with a fast car. How comforting the clink of brandy flask. How heady the scent of fine malt whiskey. How beautiful the unfolding panorama of our dear English countryside as dawn spread her rosy fingers over pasture and water meadow, over mist-shrouded cattle and sentinel heron, over slumbering thatch and puttering rill. We arrived at our club in good time for breakfast. How heady the scent of fine malt whiskey. How the gastric juices quickened, the tang of sizzling gammon, plump sausage, butter-drenched mushroom, spitting kidney, snarling steak, tight-coiled chop, and purring golden eggs. How the palate crooned to the caress of rich and noble claret. And how comforting the clink of brandy flask. And how heady the scent of fine malt whiskey. And then to Lord's. Lord's in all its finery. Lord's on fit. Lord's ablaze in the glory of distinguished test cricketers, both old and young. What a panoply of talent. I spotted at once Lord Harris and Sir Jack Hobbs, and within the hour had seen and spoken to such luminaries as Eric Bedser, and a gloomy fellow in shapeless grey suit and nylon socks who looked remarkably like Alec Bedser and his brother Eric. The first hint of trouble came when I found a man of unmistakable colonial appearance ensconced in my chair in the Brian Close Memorial Bar in the pavilion. He was dressed in a wide-brimmed hat with one side affixed to the crown, snuff-stained khaki-drilled jacket, navy blue PT shorts and hiker's boots, and seemed to be under the impression that I was called Blue. Dodging the stream of brown, liquid chewing tobacco which squirted from the side of his mouth, I examined the badge on the lapel of his drill jacket and discovered that the brute was none other than Mr. Keith Miller's grandmother. I summoned Griffiths from his office to remove the creature, and in the ensuing fracas received a severe bite on my left buttock and had the clasp of an MCC cufflink buckled beyond redemption. This was to prove a minor irritation in the light of subsequent events. After settling myself in my chair, somewhat painfully, I'm bound to confess, I summoned the head waiter, Bailey, to fetch me a bottle of my usual Brown and Robertson vintage tawny port. "Sorry, sir," said the lugubrious, obsequious Bailey. "We've sold out." "Sold out?" I bellowed. "That's correct," said Bailey. "Not a bottle left in the place." In the ensuing fracas, I received superficial flesh wounds on both elbows and had the point of an MCC type-in most painfully embedded 2 inches to the south-south-east of my left nipple. What could have turned into a most ugly scene was curtailed by an announcement that there would be no play before luncheon. The cheer which went up in the bar was indicative of the relief felt by one and all that our imbibing activities would not be disturbed by the necessity of having to watch a cricket match, which to one and all was an irritating diversion to the main purpose of the event. The reunion of old friends and colleagues, the swapping of yarns and badinage, and the celebration of 100 years of incredibly boring cricket articles written by Mr. E.W. Gloria Swanton. As we looked anxiously at the lowering clouds, one question was uppermost in our minds. Would the bloody thing suddenly lift, dry out the pitch, and so completely spoil our day? It was in the manner shown by generations of Englishmen beleaguered in rotting Flanders Trench, steamy African jungle, and Tesco cash desk, that with stiff upper lips and steely eyes, we faced this danger. I found myself in the company of a dwarf-like figure with large ears, name of Hazlitt or Hasnet or Hassett, who claimed to have captained his country at test match level. To me, he looked more like an undertaker suffering from a chronic attack of piles, and I felt bound to appraise him of my views. In the ensuing fracas, I received a stinging blow behind the right temple and was damn near garrotted by Mr. Geoffrey Boycott's jockstrap. However, once again, fate intervened in the form of another announcement on the public address system to the effect that the museum at the back of the pavilion was shortly to be opened with an exhibition of Mr. Gil Langley's underpants. Chairs were overturned, tables were knocked asunder, as eager members fought and scratched with each other to gain a favourable place at the head of the queue outside the museum. Peace, blessed peace, reigned in the bar. Once more, united with my friends, I established myself at a strategic point near the entrance to the gents' urinals, and soon we were soothing our tattered nerves with generous supplies of an excellent 1974 Schloss Blofeld Spathauslese. It was during this blissful lull that I and my friends heard words which sent shivers of fear and mortification rilling down the length of our respective spines. In a dark corner of the bar, standing next to the Space Invader machines, were two figures clad in white coats, one of whom was drinking Vimto out of a large Panama hat. The umpires. And they were deep in earnest conversation. We held our breath. We strained our ears. And then we heard those terrifying words. "Right then, Dickie, we'll tell them. We'll resume play immediately after lunch." In the ensuing fracas, I received several sharp kicks in my private parts and was set upon by several burly men who smelled strongly of fresh scorecards and tavernous fruit drops. Despite my frenzied protestations and struggles, I was forcibly thrown into the gents' urinals, and there, as I slid and slithered on the tiled floor, I heard the unmistakable sound of a padlock being applied to the outside of the door. I leapt to my feet. I hammered at the door. I heaved at the handle. All to no avail. I was locked in. I shouted. I bellowed. And then suddenly I was aware of another's presence. I turned, and there, placidly standing at a stall, attending to a call of nature, was none other than Mr. K.D. Slasher Mackay of Queensland and Australia. To see him standing there, so cool, calm and collected, set off a chain of emotions in me, which to this day remain blurred and confused. Suffice it to say that in the ensuing fracas, several articles of a plumbing nature were detached from the walls of the urinal, and I was knocked into oblivion by a particularly large Edrich & Compton patent ball cock. How long I remained unconscious, I do not know. I remember waking slowly to hear on the public address system an announcement that, owing to unfortunate and unforeseen circumstances in the pavilion, the entire urinal facilities of the ground had been rendered inoperative. The effect was instantaneous. Imagine it. 20,000 to 30,000 healthy, red-blooded English males denied an outlet for one of the most basic and fundamental of human needs. Thus the outcry. Thus the uproar. Thus the assault on umpires. Thus the abuse of committee members of MCC. Thus the clamour and the violence. Thus the fact that despite the appearance of strong sunshine and a brisk drying wind in mid-afternoon, the pitch remained sodden. Well, there was only one place available for the 20,000 to 30,000 healthy, red-blooded English males. I was there. Oh, yes. I was there.
Robin Bailey was reading the last of 5 cricketing tales from a long room by Peter Tinniswood. They were abridged for radio by the author and produced by Tony Cliff.